ఓం సహనాభవతు సహనౌనః వీర్యం కరవావహై తేజస్విని We have been discussing what are known as the Upanishads. And for those of you who have not been here during the past few Friday evenings, something that we say may be a bit strange. And if you find something strange, we'll discuss it tomorrow afternoon. What we might call God, the Self, or Cosmic Consciousness, or the Infinite, or the Absolute, is infinite. The Infinite is therefore omnipresent, everywhere, by definition. And as we saw last week, it can be approached anywhere, at any time, in anything. It being in all, not confined to all, but in all, can be reached in all, through all, everywhere, at all times. There is a bit of a problem. The problem is, you cannot possibly reach out for it without complicating the problem. Scientists have been examining the world outside in the sense, outside my skin. And they are still searching, still looking. Until very recently, they believed that the outside world was an independent reality. So that it doesn't matter whether you are an Australian or an Indian or a Chinese or an Eskimo, you would still call this water, or in some other language, doesn't matter. That would still be water to you. It wouldn't be, for instance, a donkey. But now they are beginning to doubt. Now they are beginning to appreciate, apprehend, or fear that the observing intelligence somehow interferes with the observation, and therefore the truth is distorted. There is a very beautiful small booklet. If you have ever seen this anywhere, even in your library, it is very small, and I'm afraid I didn't even get the title of the book. It's fascinating. It contained about 20 or 30 photographs. I saw it about 10 years ago, so my memory is not very keen. About 20 or 30 photographs. divided into two sections. The main theme of the series of photographs was exactly the same, identical, in both sections. A young and beautiful girl sitting outside her little house, Spanish type house, with a sewing machine in front of her and some material. That's it. The hand is there, or to push the material into the sewing machine. Now, from this scenery, the two groups move. One group moves away and the other group moves towards. Assuming that the first photograph was taken at a distance of 10 feet, so that you could see the girl, you could see the part of the house. And also a little bit of the background. The photographer had hypothetically moved 10 times the distance each time. If it was 10 feet to begin with, the next photograph was taken 100 feet away, and the next 100 into 100. 100 into 10 or whatever it is. I think it is squared each time. And so on. So that by the time you get to about the 10th picture, you are seeing not the girl or the house, you are seeing the galaxy. Because they have been going away and away and away. Already in the third picture, the girl is nearly vanished. Because you are seeing the Earth from the orbit, outer space. This is the other point of view, expanding point of view. The other series, once again, the first photograph was taken 10 feet away. You come closer, 1 foot away. So that all that you see is the fingers of the girl. Then you could come closer to still. Afterwards, it's more speculative. You come close to the finger, and what do you see there? In the finger which was about to feed the material into the sewing machine, you see one grain of sugar and one mosquito. Then you get a little closer. I don't know what that means, you figure out. You see only the sugar cube, or the sugar molecule, particle, the grain. Then you get into the sugar. Because the sugar has some dimensions too. So you are going to divide it by its square root. Get into the sugar. And once you get into the sugar, you get the molecules. And you get into the molecules. Then you get the atomic structure. You get into the atomic structure. You go on like this. But every time you go in, you don't see something very small, but you see something very big. The subatomic particles at that point have become enormous. The space inside that sugar has become enormous. Whereas as you recede, the house becomes almost a speck of dust on the landscape. The earth becomes just a particle of dust floating in space. You don't even see the earth, you see the solar system just dangling around somewhere. So, there are so many points of view. What do we look like? It It's impossible to answer that question without at the same time asking, who are you? What is your point of view? So that whether or not there is an independent external factor, external reality, it is greatly dependent upon the subject. And so, the yogi, without denying the existence of an external reality, suggested, let it be, but find out who you are. It's easier to examine the camera than to examine the universe. That's all there is. It's easier to find out what your camera looks like, what the power of the lens is, what it is capable of doing, instead of trying to figure out what the external universe looks like. The simple truth. And so, realizing that in every form of knowledge that we seek, the mind is the most vital factor. They should understand your mind. Even when it comes to experiential situations, the mind is capable of presenting varied pictures. In our relationships, in our estimation of others, and in our estimation of ourselves, which we almost involuntarily keep making. However much you try not to, you keep making images of yourself and images of others. Your whole life is dependent upon that, upon these two images clashing or kissing. Doesn't matter what they do, but they do, whatever they do, there is a problem. You are not doing anything, it is merely these images clashing, dangling. So, the yogis suggest, the sages suggest, the mystics suggest, try to understand yourself. Because when you try to understand yourself, you have only got one problem. You are not involved in the other problem, which is the other person or the other object. It is easier for me to find out why I want this glass of water. Then to figure out what the value of that water is. How can I evaluate this water? It may be worth a million. If there is no drinking water at all in Perth, and all of us want this glass of water, it may be worth nothing. Oh, again, we are back to square one. Depending upon how badly I need it, you need it. That is the basic approach of the Upanishads. It's important to examine The whole structure of knowledge not merely the statistics of it statistics or statistics because if you are going to state statistics nothing is static in this world everything is moving so your statistics don't stick it's all in a state of flux as Buddha said and you imagine it is all static and you are sticking something the statistics don't work The problem of knowledge has to be dealt with fundamentally, and that is to know the knower, to understand the knower, to understand the mechanism of knowledge, which means self-knowledge. There are several theories concerning the external world, how it was created and all the rest of it. And even some of those theories are found in the Upanishads. In passing, they give you this sort of information. But one thing is never forgotten, that it is the self that observes all this. God is neither affirmed or denied. There are several inspiring passages proclaiming the existence of God, and there are several devastating passages ridiculing the whole idea of God. When they ridicule the idea of God, they ridicule, please remember, the idea and not God. We'll come to that in a few minutes. But all through the Upanishads, there is this one insistent demand. Before you can attempt to know the world, which means even your neighbor, and which means even your wife or husband, they are the nearest neighbors. Eh? First know yourself. Find out who you are. Find out. So with this question, a young man goes to a sage, to an enlightened man. Kene shudam patati preshutam manaha. Kena prana prathopaiti yukta kena shatam vacham imam vadanti chakshu sotram kau devo yunakti. Sir, I have a question. We'll take only one or two small bits, we won't deal with the whole thing. I am able to speak. How? What makes me speak? I am able to think. What makes me think? Who makes me think? What makes me think? There is a romantic mistake we commit all the time. And that is, the moment a question is answered, and the ball is back into your court, you feel infra-dig to pursue that question. I don't know if you noticed it. In your own behavior, She says, "What is this, Swami?" "It's a microphone, madam." "Oh, I see." Goes away. "What do you know about microphone?" "I'll give you few words that you use like mad in your everyday lives. Computer. What do you know about computer?" "We all use the word computer. As if we know everything about it." I don't know if you have seen it in your own lives. You go and ask somebody, "What is this?" And they give you an answer. You don't understand it. Or definitely you don't understand it. I'm sure. 80% of the things that whose descriptions are given to us, we don't understand. This lady shines a little light on into my eyes. I ask her, "What is this?" "Oh, it is ophthalmoscope." "Oh, I see. I don't see anything." To ask a supplementary question for clarification seems to hurt our ego. And so we behave like people behave over the telephone. I don't know if you have ever, I'm sure you have used this expression, but you may not have wondered what it means. Somebody in Sydney says, "Oh, my dear, it's been raining cats and dogs here." "Oh, I see. You don't see anything. You are in Perth. How can you see what is happening in Sydney?" "Oh, I see." "What did you see?" Such expressions are totally meaningless, and we are fond of them. Extremely fond of them. And so when you ask a question, "What makes me see?" And our friend says, "You know, there is an optic nerve." "Oh, I see." "Oh, well. You are able to see because of the optic nerve." "Optic nerve? I don't know what optic means. I don't know what nerve means." "What makes the optic nerve see?" That's the question. "Oh, is that so? There is a brain center there." All right. "What makes the brain cell see?" Either you are mad or I am mad. Get out. Go on, pursue it. If you don't, you end up with the whole junk of words, junk shop, junk heap of words, which mean nothing, but we are highly civilized, and I've heard this thrown at us who are past 50. These children, they know a lot more nowadays than you and I knew. I'm very doubtful. They don't know any more than we knew. We had a whole lot of words in our days, and they have a whole lot of words in their days. We didn't bother to examine them, and they don't bother to examine them now. We are living in a supermarket of labels. The only remedy is this. If you want to know about something, go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Till, instead of a knowledge explosion, as it is called, or information explosion, or statistics explosion, you have some other sort of explosion within you. Till then, go on. The sage in this Upanishad was probably not A scientist, according to our definition, and so he doesn't mince words. He had not studied physiology or psychology. But he obviously had direct and what is called intuitive knowledge. I don't know what this word intuition really means. To me, intuition, I never had tuition except at school. But tuition means tuition. You know, you go to his teacher and he says something and you listen to it. Intuition could either mean that this tutor is within you, or the opposite of tuition. Definite, indefinite means the opposite of definite. So intuition means there is no tuition. Find out yourself. Look within and examine it. This sage had obviously intuitively realized the answer. Shrotrasya shrotram manaso mano. What is it? The mind of your mind. Deep within you, deep within that mind, it's a mind. Deep within your ear, there is an ear. The ear being only an ornament. It's nice, it looks nice. Probably if this thing was not there, we would still hear. There are animals and reptiles which don't have ear and still they hear somehow. We could still manage it. But having become accustomed to having these two things, I think it's very nice, beautiful. The faculty of hearing, or something deeper within, there is something which hears through the ear. There is something which thinks through the mind. Oh. And this sage has the honesty and the courage to say, we don't know how to teach it. I wonder how many of us have that courage. But the moment the master, the sage, says this, a tremendous revolution takes place in you. You are no longer looking up to him, you are looking into yourself. I come to you with a question, what is mind? And you merely give a hint, mind, it's something very deep. I don't know how to teach, I don't know how to explain this. And as I am watching you, I somehow begin to understand it. I have great respect for you, great faith in you, and therefore I come to you. And suddenly I realize that this is something which is, but beyond expression, what can that be? In that moment, I am tempted to go within. Then he says, well, people have called it God. And the Upanishad calls it Brahman. Doesn't matter, it's all same. It's God who makes you think. It is God who makes you speak. It's God who makes you see. Oh, I see. We go to the temple on Friday evenings and they give us nice prasad. Wait one day. Yet chakshusha na pashyati, yena chakshumshi pashyati, tadeva brahmatvam viddhi, nedam yadidam upasate. This is not God. You can still worship, please do. Please go to the temple, go to the church, go to the synagogue, go to the mosque, go wherever you want, sit and meditate, please do. There is no condemnation. The Upanishad doesn't say, oh, you should not worship this, if you worship you will go to hell, no. This is not what we are talking about. We are talking about God. This is not what we are talking about. Yet chakshusha na pashyati. You cannot see that with your eyes. Yena chakshumshi pashyati. But it is because of that you are able to see. So, if you adopt the negative approach, you cannot see God, you cannot hear God, you cannot think of God. Okay, who owns the God? No. It is because of Him you are able to see. It is because of Him you are able to think. It's because of Him you are able to hear. Oh, then I must see. If everything that I do depends upon this God, I must come to terms with Him. Otherwise I might mess up the whole thing. Yet chakshusha na pashyati, yena chakshumshi pashyati. You cannot see this God with your eyes because He is the one that makes you see. Oh. Tadeva brahmatvam viddhi nedam yadatam upasate yen manasa na manute. You cannot think of that God. Yena ahur mano matam. It's because of Him you are able to think. What is the root of my own thinking process? Where does the thought arise? That's probably where God is. And if I can communicate with that God somehow, then I can make Him think nice thoughts, proper thoughts, positive thinking, negative thinking, realistic thinking, unrealistic thinking, and all the rest of it can be made possible if only I know where this God is making me think. Go on, stirring all these things up. So, the sage has answered without answering. Without directly answering this question and telling him, here it is, this is the one, the sages guided him. Quite likely this young man, young questioner, said, I see, that is dangerous, here says the master. Yedi manyasesu vedeti. If you think you know, you are a fool. Because just now I told you, it cannot be thought of. Naham manyasesu vedeti. No, na vedeti vedacha. He says, no, I don't think I know. But I don't even know that I don't know. Don't be hasty. I don't know this, but I don't even know that I don't know. No, na vedeti veda cha. And yet, this is the most important thing in our lives. The Upanishad Rishi says, if you know it here and now, Atha Satyam Asti, then you are established in truth. Nacheri Havin Vedin Mahati Vinashtihi. If you don't know, there is great loss. Great loss. Bhuteshu Bhuteshu Vichityadhira Pretyaspan Loka Dhamrta Bhavanti. If you know this, that which enables the mind to think, the mouth to speak, the tongue to speak, the eyes to hear, the ears to hear, the eyes to see, then you realize that that is exactly the same power that operates throughout the universe, bringing about all these things, seeing, hearing and thinking and so on, were taken here merely as a sample. This is the cosmic power. This is the universal power. That dwelling within all brings about all these things. Yesterday somebody read from the Bible, St. John's Gospel according to St. John. And there is a beautiful expression there. He came into earth, the earth knew him not, and that sort of thing. A similar expression occurs in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is a lot more terse and a lot more difficult to deal with. The same truth which occurs in the Kena Upanishad is greatly expanded and given to us in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Yo manasi tishthan manasontaraha. That which rests in your mind, manasontaraha, is deeply embedded within the mind. Yam manona veda yasya manam shariram. That which the mind does not know, that which is, or to whom your mind is the body. Your mind is the body of that which the mind itself does not know. More like some sort of puzzle. Conundrum. Yo manasyan antaro yamayatyesha. Yo manasyantaro yamayatyesha. Remaining within this mind, with the mind itself as its body, it moves the mind, it prompts the mind, it enables the mind to function. Yesha, Atma Antarjam Yamrtah. This is yourself. This is the self. Antaryam. He is the inner controller. Not you, not the ego, not me, the personality. Something deep within you. Remaining there, unknown, you may even say unknowable by the mind and the senses. It is there, and all your thoughts and actions and so on, whatever goes on arises there. Even your mind is its body. This body is nothing. This body is perhaps the outermost covering. Deep within you there is the mind, and mind itself is the body of this God. Figuratively speaking, metaphorically speaking. Hesha Atma Antadyam Yamrutah. Similar to this Keno Upanishad, you also have the same thing repeated again several times. He is in earth, and earth is his body, earth does not know him. And from within the earth, he makes the earth earth. It's fantastic, isn't it? We don't contemplate all this. Why is it that only hair grows on the head? Sort of nail can grow there. Eh? What stops a nail from growing right in the top of the head? Whatever, you shave it off, even after you shave it off, a nail does not grow, only hair grows. Fantastic. How does it know? Somebody deep within says, no, only hair grows there, nail grows here. Fantastic. What makes all these possible? What determines that earth should be like this? What determines that wind or air should be like this? What determines that water should be like this? The more you study these problems in physics, the more you are thrilled within yourself. Merely to contemplate this fantastic intelligence. Esha Atma Antadyam Yamrutah. That is the immortal, eternal, infinite core of all beings. Bhuteshu Bhuteshu Vichittirira Pretyasman Loka Namrata Bhavanti. If one is able to contemplate this and understand that this is the truth that indwells all beings, then you are free. Vedya Atman Loka Namrata Bhavanti. Once his body drops, as long as the body is there, you will still eat, drink, and do all sorts of crazy things, I guess. But once it is over, it's over. You don't have any more ignorance to bind you down to this earth plane. The sage had said all this, and probably he wanted to illustrate this. Is this inner ruler, inner controller, this innermost God, innermost divine core that enables you to live, that enables you to think, that enables you to speak. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter whether your speech is kind or unkind, all that arises from there. Which, just follow this a bit carefully, then you will understand something magical. Whether it is kind or unkind, all that arises from the same God. I contemplate this truth, I come out of my meditation room, let's say, and somebody is very kind to me, Swami, you are a nice person. Yes, that also arises in the same God. He says, you are a jolly good rascal, what are you bluffing us for? That also arises in exactly the same God. I am safe. Will an unkind thought or word arise in me doubtfully? Absolutely nothing, no unkindness to which I should react in an unkind way. So, without struggling with all these problems, the problem is diffused, it's gone. That's the beauty, that's the magic. Can some unkindness flow from me also? Yes. Not from me, but from that core. When it has to be, it has to be. For instance, supposing I'm eating something and something that a couple of peas go the wrong way and I start choking, she might get up and be hitting my back. It's not because she wants to eat me, but she's doing some good. I may have an appendicitis now, and some doctor might come and cut open my abdomen, not because he wants to hurt me, but because he wants to save me. So all sorts of things are possible, but this simple truth must be clearly seen, not thought about. It must be a truth, which is true, not a thought, not an idea. All ideas are rubbish. And whether or not we accept this, actions do not arise from your ideas. I suggest, I guess this is fairly controversial, but please consider this. Actions do not arise from your ideas. Actions arise somewhere else. So, your ideas, you can keep on entertaining your ideas for the rest of your lives. They are useless, waste of time. That's all. To be conscious of this divine core within us, that is wisdom, not leads to wisdom, that is wisdom, that is enlightenment. To illustrate this simple truth, the sage gives a story. In the legends of the world, east, west, north, south, center, we always have some sort of conflict, and the conflict is always between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. Don't be afraid, we all belong to forces of light and everybody else is a force. Everybody else belongs to the force of darkness. That's the usual thing. There is this constant conflict going on, and the gods or the angels, the forces of light, had won by the grace of God. I'll continue the story. I suddenly remember a beautiful poem that I read when I was at school. I don't remember the poem, but I can tell you the story. This relates to another culture, the Muslim culture. A Muslim, what do you call him? Sheikh, or an emir, wanted to build a big palace right on the bank of the turbulent river. Take plenty of money and pour all that money and build an enormous and beautiful thing. The day after it was built, before he moved in, he went to examine it And he said, ha ha ha, what a beautiful thing I have brought, created. We'll move in day after tomorrow. And he went home, there was a flood at night, washed the whole thing away. Dreadful. Okay, so this is an accident, built again. Again it was built. Again this great big shake went there and twirled his moustache and said, what a lovely thing I have created. Thank you, very nice architect and very nice builders. I'll come and occupy tomorrow. At night there is a flood and it's also gone. Third time it was built, he came, there by the grace of God stands this magnificent structure. Isn't that beautiful? That thing stood. It wasn't washed away. So, it is by the grace of God all these things exist. And it is by the grace of God these forces of light won a victory over the forces of darkness. But naturally, they were proud. As all of us are wont to, if things go well, we say, oh, you know, I didn't say, oh my. If things don't go well, hard luck. Why don't you say good luck? Do you have to do the other thing? So, they were boasting. We were the ones that fought, and you know how I fought. There were three angels who were involved in this boasting campaign. And as they were walking away from the field of battle, suddenly they saw an apparition, though close to them, just at a distance. These three gods, they stopped. One was Indra, supposed to be the king of heaven. The other was the god of fire. And the third was the god of wind. These were the chief force warriors, soldiers, in the ranks of the force of dark, light. They stopped and they looked at this god of fire. Hey, go and find out what that is. It's funny. This god of fire went there, looked up, hey, who are you? And perhaps there is maybe a mountain or something there. There is echo, who are you? That thing, that apparition asked back, who are you? Don't you know I am the god of fire? What can you do? I can burn everything. Everything in the world I can burn. That thing, whatever it was, picked up a dry blade of grass, put it in front, burn this. However much this god of fire tried to burn that, it wouldn't burn. My God, what is this? Better disappear before something else happens. So this god of fire retreated, went and told these other two, I don't know what it is. And they said, all right, wind god, you go and see what that is. The wind god came. He stood there and said, who are you? And that one said, who are you? I am wind god. But sir, what can you do? I can blow everything. In the whole earth, solar system I can blow away. Okay, here, Eva. The same blade of grass, dry blade of grass. Put it there. Come on, blow it. And the wind god went for it with all his might and main. Didn't even budge. He turned round, ran back. Now, I don't know where I saw this. Again, in a scientific journal or book. Normally, if even a seasoned diver goes into the ocean, he has to wear all kinds of things to protect his skin against pressure. They say something, how much is it? 2,000 feet. You can't even go 2,000 feet, is it? Something they say, if you go beyond, below a certain depth, your blood vessels burst. Your skin burst, everything is blown. So that deep sea divers have to have all sorts of equipment. And then, if you want to go further, you go into some kind of submarine and go down. Pressurized cabin. And they, some of these marine biologists who were investigating this, they went down the Pacific Ocean. They had their own coat of arms and they had the cabin and all that, pressurized cabin and all that. Then they looked with amazement at a little earthworm right at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. That doesn't burst a blood vessel. It's sitting there very quietly, chewing its own food. Who endowed that little earthworm with that much of strength, with whatever that means? It is that one that was standing in front of these gods. So, when that one willed that this straw shall not burn, it will not burn. That's all. When that god or whatever you wish to call it, wills that this earthworm shall not burst, and it will not burst. You can do what you like. But God has to will, not you. Please remember that. Don't jump into the sea and say, all right, I am willing now. Your will doesn't work. He has to will. And so this god of wind also retreated. Then came Indra, the chief of gods. This is a little bit of fun. As he was coming, approaching this apparition, he disappears and in its place stands Uma, the goddess of wisdom. And Indra, the chief of gods, asks her, who was that? And she says, Indra, it was God. It was through His grace that you won the victory. She forgot. He came to remind him. And also there is a sidelight to the story. The story is over for all our purposes. The sidelight to the story, that is, God cannot be directly known, but has to be understood by means of wisdom, represented here by the goddess of wisdom, or by means of the guru, represented here again by this lady, goddess. Underlining this factor, some of the scriptures give a rather not so pleasant to hear, I guess, dramatic admonition. When you begin to argue, prove that God exists, otherwise I won't take it. They say, don't be silly. You have to have some faith in the scriptures, in the sages, in your guru, and in wisdom, in intuition. You have to have faith. Without faith, don't think that merely by your own cleverness you can find the answer. Having said that, they ran this simple truth down our throat with a shocking statement. You see, the identity of you and your father, you have to learn from your mother. Right, correct. You have to have faith. You can't go and ask your mother, prove it. She says, he is your father, that's it, keep quiet. No more questioning. So at one point, faith and nothing else is of any use. Have this faith and then cultivate wisdom and intuition. You will go up to a certain point till the revelation happens within you.